Welcome, everybody. My name is Gwen Mandel, and I am the Director of National Outreach for Independent Voting. And welcome to tonight's conference call with Independent Voting President Jackie Salit. It's really such an honor to host this call, and especially to hear the voices of those of you who are on the call for the first time. Now, I did a rough count as you were signing on, and I counted 40 states represented tonight. So that's wonderful. Now, these calls with Jackie are the perfect way for you to introduce others to the independent movement, so please feel free to do that for our next call, which will be Monday, May 13th. Tonight's call takes place just as the 2020 presidential campaign is getting underway. And you can tell it started because the media circus has begun with its hyper-focus on the candidates. Who's announced, who might announce, who should or shouldn't announce. And while they're trying to control the action, as Jackie said on our last conference call, there's a lot of football to be played. So many of the questions that you sent in, and actually at last count we got 120 at least, the questions touch on these things, and you know we've organized them into themes, so I think we'll be able to get to a lot of your concerns tonight. At the same time as the candidates are positioning themselves, we independents are positioning ourselves too. And we're focusing on the process, the rules of the game, and on expanding democracy. As you may know, we launched a campaign called Eyes on 2020 to amplify independents' voice in the presidential process. My co-host tonight is Randy Fricke, a member of Independent Voting's newly formed Eyes on 2020 cabinet. Randy has been setting the standard in Western Colorado for how to build independent organization. In the spring of 2018, in the wake of Colorado passing an initiative for open primaries, he saw the major parties begin their caucus process, and he asked, why shouldn't independents have a caucus as well? So he set out to organize one, and he established Western Colorado Independent Voters. He's building a vibrant organization of independents in the state. Welcome, Randy.
Wow, Gwen, that was pretty awesome. Well, thanks, Gwen, and good evening, everyone. It's an honor to be co-hosting this call tonight. As Gwen mentioned, I started Western Colorado Independent Voters after I saw our local newspapers giving free advertising to the Democratic and Republican parties for their preparations for their primary elections. It's upsetting that the two major parties dominate the news cycles year after year, especially when independent voters outnumber Democrats and Republicans in my county. Statewide, independents make up about 36% of the registered voters in Colorado. And even though we held our first semi-open primary in 2018, independents still had to pick a ballot and vote either straight Democratic Party or a straight Republican Party ticket. This was only a small step toward election reform. So the main motivating factor for me was that I was fed up that independents are not getting any respect from the two major parties, and as well as the news media. On March 22nd of last year, we held our first independent voter meeting. Our outreach covers the very large 3rd Congressional District here in the West. It is definitely a work in progress. We have a mission statement and a platform, which you can see on our Facebook page under Western Colorado Independent Voters. Next, I would like to give a shout-out to two of my WCIV members who have been a great help to me, Gwen Ballard and Fred Malo Jr., both of Carbondale, Colorado. Without them, I could not do what I do. That also goes for the Election Reform Committee and the National Staff of Independent Voting. Thank you, guys. Now, Jackie Salit, the president of Independent Voters, is an icon in our independent voter movement. I admire her history and involvement in American politics and her energy and strength in keeping the independent voter movement growing. The launching of Eyes on 2020 will position independent voters to be major players on America's political landscape. Get ready, America. Independent voters are about to make history. Ladies and gentlemen, I give you Jackie Salit.
Well, good evening, everyone, and thank you so much, Gwen and Randy, for co-hosting the call tonight. And I, as always, I really enjoyed hearing everybody sign in from around the country, folks who I know and have worked with, folks I've just met in recent times, and people who are joining us for the first time. Welcome to everyone, and a special thank you, Randy, to you for the work that you do and for your kind words about me, and I'm going to shout some of them back out to you because I have so much admiration and respect for what you've been doing in Colorado and the voice that you are giving to independent voters in that state and around the country. So thank you so much for that. I know we have a lot of ground to cover tonight, so I'm going to kick it back to the two of you, and I know you've been distilling and organizing the questions that have come in from all around the country, so let me hand it back to you, and let's get to work and see what we can dig in on.
Okay. Kicking off with some questions associated with the title of the call, Howard Schultz and the Spoiler Effect. The question that came in addressed this from many different angles. For example, how do you respond to the notion that we must defeat Trump at all costs, and in order to do that, according to the Democrats' line of reasoning, we must submerge all other goals for the moment? Some folks want to know your opinion of Howard Schultz. Others are asking how to rebut the spoiler argument and whether, in the words of one activist, do we have a solid retort in overcoming such fear-based reactions, often directed toward independence? Still others ask, do you see the possibility of an independent in 2020?
All right. Well, that is a rich and complicated set of questions, and let me see if I can break them down and share some of my current thinking about them. These are all really important topics here. First of all, let me say that a lesson that I have learned personally over many years, actually many decades in politics and in independent politics in particular, is it's really important to be where you are in any given process. You have to play the game that's on the field now. Don't play last week's game, and don't play next week's game. Play the game that you're playing right now. And so I just wanted to emphasize that because I think that part of what we're seeing right now is a lot of pressure coming onto the independent movement in a lot of ways, and hopefully we'll talk about that during the course of the night tonight. And I want to have us be responding to that pressure, but I also don't want to get over-determined by it, and I think it's very important for us to define our own terms. So first off, let me say some things about the term spoiler in general. I don't really like the term. I don't approve of the term. I am a very firm believer in the concept that no party owns a vote. No party owns a voter. And I think that part of what's happening in the country today is that as more and more people, many of whom are independents, but many of whom are also Democrats and Republicans or members of third parties of one kind or another, the more that people are becoming disaffected and are looking for ways to break out of the partisan gridlock, the partisan control, the partisan culture that is so dominant in our political system, the more that people are becoming disaffected with the status quo and looking for change, I think the more the spoiler argument, such as it is, really reveals itself, frankly, as a form of voter suppression, essentially saying, you're not allowed to consider an alternative. You're not allowed to create new coalitions. You have to stay within the political terrain, the political alignments, the political parties as they are currently constructed. So I personally have difficulty with the spoiler term in general. That said, though, the spoiler argument, as was mentioned in the questions, Randy, that you just brought up, is coming up now because this is a charge that has been made against Howard Schultz, who, as people on the call know, actually isn't even running for president. He's considering a run for president and has been discussing that publicly. But just the mere mention of the possibility of his considering a run has brought forth this torrent of attack. And right away, literally, and I know that at least some of you, you know, watched the appearance that he did on CBS Television News on the show 60 Minutes. And literally before the segment in which he was discussing this was over, there were already all kinds of commentators on TV and people on Twitter and this one and another one and so on and so forth who were saying this is completely out of the question. This should not be discussed. Who the hell is this guy anyway? Et cetera, et cetera, and so forth. And this is not the way to go. So I think that, to my way of thinking, one of the ways that we need to respond, or certainly the way that I respond to that, is I say, well, wait a second, who decided that? Who decided that it is impermissible to have a public discussion about the possibility of an independent candidate for president? People say, oh, well, we can't discuss that because we absolutely, positively have to defeat Donald Trump. Trump is terrible. We have to defeat Donald Trump. So, I am in no way a supporter or a fan of President Trump. But I have to say, when people are saying this, we can't have this discussion, et cetera, I look at who it is that the people are who are saying this, the people who are saying, we can't have this discussion because we have to defeat Donald Trump. I look at who the people are who are saying this, and I think, well, wait a second. Aren't you the people, aren't you the same people that ran the campaign that gave us Trump? Aren't you the people who couldn't figure out what you had to do and what you had to create and what you had to offer to the American people such that they wouldn't vote for Trump, but they would vote for you? Oh, they say, oh, but Trump is so bad. Trump is so bad. We can't take any chances. I listen to this because, honestly, I tell you, even though sometimes things go on that I get, you know, worked up about and I get angry about and I might yell at the TV or whatever, I do try to listen hard to what's being said. And when people say, oh, you know, we can't take any chances, I say, well, all right, that's what you said the last time. We can't take any chances. That's why we have to nominate this Democrat. That's why we have to vote for this Democrat. That's what you said the last time. But maybe even more importantly than that, what if it's the case that the American people decide that we want to take some chances? What if the mood in the country, what if the distress over the state of our politics is such that people are saying, you know, we really have to find some ways to try some new things. Don't we have the right to do that? Don't we have the right to consider these kinds of alternatives? Or have you already rewritten the Constitution to rule out anything that isn't sanctioned by the two parties? A Constitution which, by the way, as many of you know, doesn't even mention the word party, because parties were never contemplated in the original design of our country. So I'm saying all of this to you tonight. I'm not here making an argument for Howard Schultz for president. I've watched Howard on TV. He has said some things that I like. He said some things that I don't particularly like. I hope, honestly, that he will reach out and connect with independents in our movement, including with all of you. And I hope that as he goes through his process, that he will allow himself to be shaped and actually to be led by the 40% of Americans who are independents. But I will say, you know, to people who asked, Randy, as you were summarizing the questions, people who are asking, well, what do I think of Schultz and all of that, here's what I would say. I actually think that he's already done two things that are important to our movement and important to our country. Number one, he said 40% of the country today are independents. He said this on national TV. He actually said it more than once. Now, this sounds like a simple thing to do, a simple thing to say, but even saying that sentence provoked a storm of controversy from the political science community and from the media. Oh, those independents, they don't really exist. That 40% number is inflated. People aren't really independents. They really are leaners. They really are this. They really are that. No. No. 40% of the country are independents. That's how they describe themselves. And that is the definition in this country of who you are. You get to do that in the United States of America. You get to do that. That's part of what it means to be an American. You get to do that. And so I think Howard has done a great service to the country and to our movement by simply stating that fact on national television. The other thing that he's done, which I think is worth noting, is that because he's put out this public discussion about a possible candidacy, and he's drawn fire from the Democratic Party for doing so, I think that part of what he has done here is to perhaps reveal and expose to a greater degree that the Democratic Party has many, many conflicts and differences within it that is pulling it in many, many different directions. And in order to be sure that they can coalesce all of those different elements, many of whom are really at opposite ends of the spectrum on a whole host of issues, in order to be able to make sure that they can pull that coalition together, they had to draw out that spoiler argument early and hard and try to make it stick. And so I think that tells us something about the state of the opposition to Trump. And if a concern is what is the alternative that is going to be presented to the American people, to the current president and the current White House, it raises the issue of whether a weakened and conflicted and insecure political institution, which lost the last election to Trump, can play the role that it intends to play, or should we at least consider some other alternatives, and should we consider ways to reconstruct or construct a new electoral coalition going into 2020 that is built on a different foundation than what has come before? So, you know, I think these things are very much in flux and in process. I don't know where the Schultz candidacy is going to go and if there is even going to be one. But I do know, and I feel very strongly about this, that it's very, very important for the independent movement and for those of us working in so many states and in so many different organizing situations around the country, very, very important for us to be educating people about this. And in some sense, I would even say slowing things down a little bit. Let's not run right now to the end of the presidential process. We're not there. We're somewhere else. And let's make sure that independent voters have a way to be heard about the way we want the process to go, about the terms of the process, about what the rules of the game are going to be, and about how this huge, major community of voters, 40% of the country is going to be related to, is going to be recognized, is going to be respected as part of that process. That's our job. And so this is what I spend a lot of my time thinking about and talking to people about and developing strategies and tactics for. So I'm so glad we're having an opportunity to talk about it tonight.
Yeah, me too, Jackie. Thank you. That's very helpful. Very interesting. You know, many questions came in about the field of candidates that's shaping up for 2020. One person asked if you see any of the current lot of candidates influenced by the growth of independents. Another asked if you think Trump winning the previous election changed the dynamic of presidential elections relative to paving the way for independents to have more of an impact. And some wanted to know whether the entrance of Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side and William Weld on the Republican side present any opportunities for independents. And there was also a point of information type question, interesting question from someone who wanted to know how many independents actually end up voting Democrat or Republican. What are your thoughts about this?
Okay. Well, first, I would say that I think that all of the candidates and the fundamental dynamics of the 2020 presidential election are being influenced by independent voters. Whether a candidate acknowledges that's another question. And whether any of the major parties acknowledge that is another question. But I honestly think that is really undeniable. And, you know, let me just do like a brief piece of history here, just to recap and recount some things that I know all of the political players are paying very close attention to. In 2008, independent voters who participated in the primary season in the states that allowed independents to vote made Barack Obama the Democratic Party nominee. They also made John McCain the Republican nominee. And then independents went on to support Obama by a majority in the general election and sent him to the White House. 2 years later, independents, somewhat disillusioned and disaffected by the extent to which Obama's broad coalition was being narrowed and partisanized in many respects by the Democratic Party, switched gears and gave control of Congress to the GOP. In 2016, independents broke in significant numbers for Donald Trump. And then in the midterms, in the last election that we just had, in 2018, independents, with a swing of like 24 points from the last midterms, gave the Democratic Party control of the House of Representatives. So what I would say about this is that, and that's like a capsule summary. There's all kinds of detail, you know, and variations from state to state and region to region, whatever. But look, if I'm any of those Democratic candidates, and there are a lot of them, and Gwen, as you pointed out, you know, in your opening, every day there's another candidate who announces, and everyone's sort of trying to figure out what's their, slice of the pie, what's their particular niche, their brand, whatever, you know, you want to call it. But with all these candidates coming out, whatever, if I'm the Democrats, if I'm a Democratic candidate for the Democratic nomination for president, I'm looking at that history, and I'm looking at those numbers, and I'm looking at the fact that, you know, in the last election, 30% of the electorate were independents, of the voting electorate were independents. That's almost 34 million voters who were independents, who came out to the polls in the midterm elections. I'm looking at that and I'm saying, for goodness sake, we need those voters. We need to assimilate them. We need to organize them. We need to inspire them. That's great. As far as I'm concerned, we're in demand. And that's a good thing because that puts us in a position to be able to leverage that strength. How that plays out, how we manage to do that, well, that's what we're working on right now, you know. And look, there's some lessons here to be learned. I mean, in the last Democratic primary where there were not, 20 candidates, there were two, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. Independent voters were very strongly breaking for and coming out to support Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primaries in the states that allowed them to vote. But truth be told, he didn't fight very hard for those independent voters. He didn't take up the question, for example, of the rules governing the primaries. And when he started to hit those states, and I heard people sign in from some of those states, Arizona, Florida, Pennsylvania, New York, some of those really big states that were, delegate-rich and had very significant numbers of independent voters in them, but they were not allowed to cast a ballot. And that is not simply a shame, and it's not simply a fairness issue. It is an issue that has to do with whether our political system is going to be structured in such a way as to reflect the actual composition of the electorate and the actual aspirations of the American people. You know, one of the things that has happened in this country over the last, I would say, 8 to 10 years, perhaps, is that the democracy issue, the process issues, the issues that have to do with the rules of the game have moved from the fringe to center stage. And I say this as somebody who has worked on these issues for decades when they were on the fringe, when you couldn't get the time of day from a member of Congress or a reporter at a major newspaper or whatever about these kinds of concerns. Well, that has really been turned on its head. And democracy has now moved to the center stage of the concerns of our republic. And the questions of, how is our system constructed? What role should the parties play? What rights should be accorded to all voters, including independents? How should we draw district lines? What should the models be for administering elections? Should the Federal Election Commission be a bipartisan body or should it be a nonpartisan body? And, I've been following, like I'm sure many of you have, the introduction of H.R. 1, the first piece of legislation that the Democratic Party has put forward since it took control of the House. And there's some good stuff in it. There is. It's a very lengthy, detailed piece of legislation. And it's got a lot of good stuff in it, but it's so incredibly conspicuous for the fact that it makes no mention whatsoever of the distress and the disalignment of the American people with the party system itself. It does not take up issues that directly affect the voting rights of independent voters at a time when this community of voters is, in 10 states, it's the largest group of voters. As a whole, it's a major, major significant part of the social and political fabric of our country. So I think that, I think we're having a very big influence, but one of the ways that you see that influence is in the form of a denial. Sometimes denial tells you more about the influence that you have than recognition does. And I think we're facing denial in a lot of different places, and this is one of them. Our job is to make them feel us. They've got to feel us in every state capital, in every early primary state, in every Super Tuesday state, in every conversation that goes on about candidates, about whether there's going to be an independent presidential campaign of some kind, what's the progress of H.R. 1 going to be, what's the culture that we want to have as a country as we move forward in these very, very challenging times. That's our issue. That's our concern. And we have to make them feel that we're there, that we're building, that we're organizing, that we're reaching more and more people, that we're changing the terms of the debate, changing the terms of the conversation, changing the terms of coalition building. So, I think I think our influence is big, and I think we're going to have to fight to make it visible and then to be able to deal off of it.
Thank you, Gwen. Thank you, Jackie. I'm sorry. Anyway, wow, that's a tremendous view of everything. Well, next, the issue of opening the presidential primaries, which are closed to independents in many states, is on the minds of many people in our network. Following up on your letter to the DNC chair, Tom Perez, 950 independents signed on to the letter asking Perez to meet. Has there been any response? Do you think there is a real chance the Democratic Party would direct the state parties to open the primaries, or was the letter more of a tool to organize independents and build the independent movement? Others asked if there was a plan to send a similar letter to the RNC chair and whether we're going to ask all of the 2020 candidates if they'll help lobby the parties to make sure all the presidential primaries are open. Can you give us a picture of Eyes on 2020, how we're doing, and where we are going next, and, of course, what people can do to participate?
Sure, I would love to. And thank you for all those questions and giving me an opportunity to talk about this. Eyes on 2020, for those of you who don't know, that's the name of the campaign that we're running to, as I was saying just before, to make them feel us and to try to build and manifest and leverage the power of the 40%. And so it has a lot of different component parts. One of them, and this is a major one right now that we have, is the campaign to pursue and to pressure the major parties to open their presidential primaries across the board to independent voters. And as you mentioned, Randy, in the question, we kicked this off with a letter to Democratic National Committee Chairman Tom Perez. We got a lot of people to sign on. We've not gotten a response yet from Chairman Perez, but we have a few contacts and connections into his office who are going to start to reach out on our behalf, and we'll see what kind of response. Do I think there's a real chance the Democratic Party would direct the state parties to open up the primaries? I do. I actually do. I know for a fact that it's a very, very controversial issue inside the party. We had discussions about this with party leaders when Obama was still president. And I know that there's a lot of dissension around it. And we all know that following the experience of the 2016 presidential election, the Democratic Party put together something called the Unity Reform Commission, which was set up explicitly for the purpose of trying to discuss and develop a perspective on the open primary question. They ultimately did not make the move that they could and should have made. They sort of punted to the states and came up with a formula which is a little bit laughable in my opinion, which is basically they decided they wouldn't open the primaries to include independents, but they would make it easier for independents to become Democrats. And when I first got the word that this was what the Unity Commission came up with, I was like, well, you know, hey, thank you very much, but no thank you. That's the whole point here is that we don't want to be required to join a political organization as a condition of voting. We think that is undemocratic. We think that violates the spirit of what this country's political system is supposed to be about, and we don't consider that a satisfactory answer. So Eyes on 2020 is designed to push back against that, and we have regular updates on how that campaign is unfolding. And if you want to stay on top of that, by the way, you can either check out our newsletter, The Hub, or you can go to the independent voting website, and if you look at the bar across the top, there's an Eyes on 2020 blog that you can click on, and it will give you all of the updated information about what's happening in different states. You know, there's we've been in touch already with the chairmen or chairwomen of a number of state parties. There's actually six states where the Democratic Party and one state where the Republican Party made the decision to open their primary in spite of the fact that they were in a closed primary state in 2016. And some of our campaign leaders have been in touch with those state party chair people and having dialogues and discussions with them. And that's been very, very interesting. And in fact, some of those state party chairs are saying, yeah, you know, we had a fight about that. I won it. It's a good thing that we did that. And so we're trying to leverage some of that as well. With respect to the question about reaching out on the Republican side, the answer to that is yes, we are. I have been speaking with some allies of ours in a number of state Republican parties who really want to pursue this issue. Of course, as this won't surprise you, that we're hearing rumblings from the Republican National Committee up top that they are actually looking at scenarios in which they not only don't open their primaries, but in which they don't hold primaries. So, you know, another form of, you know, partisan authoritarianism, but, you know, a fairly extreme one at that. But, you know, as far as the RNC is concerned, they already know who their nominee is. They don't want to go through any kind of process through which he could get beaten up along the way. There are some Republicans who've indicated the possibility of wanting to run in a Republican primary against Trump. Bill Weld is one, Larry Hogan, former governor of Maryland and former governor of Massachusetts, respectively, in backwards order, are thinking about that, and that's interesting. And they are both people who are on record of being in support of allowing independents to vote. So here's what I would say. I think the thing is very alive. I don't have the highest expectations in the world for what the outcome will be, but I do think it's very alive, and I don't think we should be cynical about it. I don't think we should prejudge it. I think we should really push very, very hard, and we have a wonderful cabinet that's leading the campaign and all kinds of things to do and things to pursue at the state level, at the local level, and at the national level with respect to pushing this issue. So I'm both hopeful about it, but I also, honestly, I just think it is important to do. Look, here's the thing. We're going to push for this as hard as we can. We're going to mobilize for this as hard as we can. We're going to deploy as much firepower as we can. I want these people on record. I don't want this cycle to go by without them having to say what their position is. I want their position to be to open it because I want to give independents the maximum channels through which to influence the shape of the election, and ultimately to decide the outcome of the election. But I want them on record. It is time. You can't hide anymore on this question. You need to go on record. We want to know where you stand on us. That's the point here. And so we're going to pursue it. We are pursuing it. We're having a good time doing it. There's all kinds of creative stuff going on, and it's a great campaign to work on, and I really encourage everybody to sign up to be a part of the campaign in your state. It's really very, very important.
Yes, sounds good. Well, let's turn to another topic a little bit. The issue of ideology came up in a number of questions. One person pointed to the recent Independent Voter Network poll that showed Trump and Bernie receiving the most votes as a candidate of choice of independents. And this person expressed surprise that the poll didn't reflect the media's depiction of independents as so-called moderates, centrists. Another asked if there were openings for new conversations about socialism, since battle lines are already being drawn among Democratic candidates as a way to differentiate from Bernie Sanders. In general, what are your thoughts about how ideology is coming into play with the emergence of a new democracy movement?
Yeah, that's such an interesting question. I don't know. In some ways, it seems lawful or poetic or something that at a time when so many people are saying, hey, let's find a way to break out of ideological categories and ideological barriers, that at a moment where that's such a strong impulse on the part of so many people, that at the same time that that's happening, that there's this push to frame everything in ideological terms. I guess that is what happens when, you know, when old paradigms and old constructs are disintegrating because they no longer serve the purpose of progress and self-governance and all of that, that they, you know, that there would be a big push to say, we've got to, everybody has to clarify where they're at ideologically. That's interesting to me. I'm not particularly interested in ideology. I am interested in values. I think values values are more important and, frankly, a more useful way of talking about some of these important issues. To me, that resonates more strongly. And look, a lot of people, regardless of their quote-unquote ideology, regardless of, you know, since you asked the question about, you know, socialism, regardless of their position on, you know, capitalism versus socialism, if they even have a position on that, and there's such a broad recognition that we are living in a time when the system, the economic system that we have, which we call capitalism, is, you know, creating enormous wealth, but at the same time, so many people live without the necessities of life all across the world. And so what are we going to do about that? How are we going to address that? To me, that is a more helpful way of talking about these issues. When you asked that question, I was reminded of appearance recently on TV that was done by Dr. Jesse Fields, who's one of our leaders, longtime leader in the independent movement, who's a physician with a medical practice in Harlem in New York. And she was invited to come on Fox News. This was like a month ago or something. And she was invited to come on Fox News to be an independent as part of a panel that was having a discussion about various kinds of issues, or at least this is how the producers pitch the thing. Anyway, so she goes on the show, and there's like six other people on the panel or whatever. And so the woman who's hosting the show, she starts talking to the panel and whatnot, and she's got her microphone, and she says, all right, she says, now, you know, we're gonna get to the important issues here, here's the first one. Panelists, do we need capitalism or socialism? I had to laugh when I heard her and saw her do this. I thought, wow, you know, this chick is really cutting to the chase here, because, you know, for the whole of the 20th century, this was the question that hundreds of millions of people tried to answer, and not by going on a talk show, but by being in the world. And suddenly now we're going to reduce all of this to a panel discussion on Fox News, you know, with a six-minute segment. And it seems so preposterous to me. Dr. Fields, who's ever eloquent and brilliant and enormously compassionate, said, well, you know, maybe those aren't the terms that we need to be talking about. Instead of talking about capitalism versus socialism, maybe we need to be talking about democracy and how we're going to develop and nourish and construct a political system that allows the American people to decide how they want to organize all of these things. What do they want to do about the inequality of wealth in our society? What do we want to do about poverty? What do we want to do about this contradiction between a system that creates so much wealth and still can't deliver that to so many people. What do we want to do about that? Well, that's a decision and a discussion that the American people have to have. So I'm with Dr. Fields on this. I thought that was just extremely eloquent and well put. And I would like us as a movement and as a network to try to reframe the conversation in this direction.
Thank you, Jackie. That's great. Let's delve further into some of the political reforms that are currently on the table. Several people want your views on ranked choice voting. Others raise questions about the Electoral College and whether there was something to be done to ensure a more democratic election in 2020. There were questions about how the legal fight to include an independent in the debates is going, as well as a request for your opinion on how top two is going in California. Finally, someone asked, is there a need for federal legislation which could regulate the conduct of parties or at least restrict certain behaviors such as closing the primaries to independents? Can you give us your assessment of some of these reforms in play?
Sure. Yeah, this is a big topic and an important one. I'm going to see if I'm going to try and do like a little bit of a lightning round on the first part and then maybe go a little deeper on the second part. Okay, my views on ranked choice voting. If I were using ranked choice voting to express my opinion on ranked choice voting, it would not be my first or second choice. I think it's an okay approach. I understand it. I honestly don't think it gets at the heart of what we need to be doing politically in terms of opening up the process and leveling the playing field for all voters and making our elections more competitive. I know other people like it and are big fans of it, and I respect their opinion. That's mine. Questions about the Electoral College. It's very, very interesting to me that while there was a whole hue and cry after 2016 about the fact that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College, that was talked about in a whole host of ways, but it's interesting to me that even so, there's not any kind of pursuit on the part of the Democratic Party to reform that aspect of how we elect a president. The legal fight to include an independent in the debates, how's that one going? Peter Ackerman from Level the Playing Field, who's done really just a brilliant job on driving this case and has been just about as dogged as you can imagine on this thing, has just, after a year's time, after the arguments were made and the papers were submitted, et cetera, the court has still not ruled, and I think we're going on now 15 months nearly since the final papers were submitted. And so Peter and his very, very brilliant legal team just submitted a new set of papers asking the court to step up and to give their ruling on this question. And it is relevant now, and I think the argument that it's become timely is important and strong, and so I hope that succeeds. Opinion on top two in California, how's that going? Well, I think it's going really well, and actually part of what's important about this is that I'm a big fan of the top two nonpartisan system. We tried to bring it to New York when Mike Bloomberg was mayor here after independents got him elected, and we couldn't get it done because the resistance from the clubhouse was so strong. I think top two is going really well in California and starting to open up some new things and new opportunities and new coalitions. I would also add, by the way, that the recent nonpartisan top two primary that was just held in Chicago to elect a new mayor has sent two women of color to the finals, Toni Preckwinkle and Lori Lightfoot. This also happened in California in the U.S. Senate race, where Kamala Harris and Loretta Sanchez became the top two finalists. And I mention that, Randy, mainly because one of the things that the Clubhouse will often attack the top two system for is they say that it disadvantages African-American and Latino voters, but actually the actual record of when that system is in place, particularly in the last batch of years, is that it creates a process in which those candidates move to the finals and get elected. And so I think that that is important. Let me just say something, though, if I might, about more broadly about the political reform agenda. And I particularly want to bring this up, given who's on the call here tonight. And I'm going to make this brief because I know we're getting close to closing time here. And I think there's a lot of different political reforms out there, and they're good. Even the ones that I'm not particularly partial to, I support their enactment. I support experimenting with all of these different modes of reforming the political process. I really do. I have a little bit of a concern at the moment that the political reform movement, broadly speaking, is getting a little soft on its support for independent voters. And I see that in a variety of ways, not least of which, frankly, is I see some organizations dropping the open primary issue off their list of preferred reforms. Or I sit in meetings and people say, well, what are the, you know, the two things that are the most important reforms that we have to enact? And nobody around the table other than me wants open primaries to be identified as one of those key reforms. So I say this because I think it, to me, it underscores the importance of the Eyes on 2020 campaign that we're running. And here's the reason. See, one of the reasons that a lot of the political reform leaders are getting a little soft on this question is they're worried that they won't get the support needed in the legislature or in the courts for whatever the particular reform is that they're trying to pursue. And basically what they say is, look, you know, there's a lot of important reforms out here, but we have to be pragmatic. We have to be practical. We really should support the things that can get done. You know, the legislative process is complicated and the legislatures are partisan and all of that kind of stuff. The beautiful thing, in my view, about the Eyes on 2020 campaign and about the push to get the presidential primaries open in 2020 is that it's the most pragmatic thing that you can pursue. It does not require the action of Congress. It does not require the action of a state legislature. It does not require the action of the courts. There is a United States Supreme Court decision called Tashjian that gives parties the right to open their primaries, to decide who they are going to allow into their primary process. So the Democratic Party, the Republican Party, at the national level and at the state levels, could do this. They could do it. And I think that is so important to keep in mind, and that's part of why I really want to push this effort and why I think it is so central to leveraging the power that independent voters have. This is a reform that rightfully should be made, and it should be made now. It's not an experiment. It's not figuring out, well, what if we voted this way, and what if we financed candidates that way, and what if we... No, this is about a basic function of how democracy works. Let all voters vote. Let's start there. So, So Randy, I'm really glad that, you know, you distilled this, because there's a lot of content here and a lot of different layers to it. But I think that there's some fundamentals here in play that we really need to stay very tight on.
Great. Thanks, Jackie. I'm going to get to our last question, which, as usual, there were a lot of how-to questions And I'm going to give you a couple of examples. One person asked, how do we best integrate with all of the other reform movements and still maintain our identity? How do we compete for resources in a world of limited resources, or do we need to? Another asked, how about helping to orchestrate a movement of people contacting the media and elected officials about the many ways elections have been rigged and voting has been suppressed for the past 20 years? One person asked for what to say to people who have stopped voting because they're so fed up, and another asked for practical, everyday things we can do to talk friends and family down from the partisan ledge without also engaging in it as well. Is there any way to change a partisan mind, he asked. And a number of people just asked, how could I help? So let's talk tactics. What are the key things independents should be doing right now? How do you respond to some of these how-to questions?
Okay, these are great. I love these. okay, how do you respond to the person who stopped voting because they're so fed up? Here's what I would say. I would say, if somebody said that to me, and people do, I would say, you know what? I totally understand. I totally get it. Help me build something that makes it worthwhile to vote. That's what we're trying to do. Help me do that. You know, contacting the media. We have a wonderful program. It's called Spokesperson Training that is run by Sarah Lyons, and it's available monthly. So I want to encourage people to sign up for that. I mean, in a lot of ways, Gwen, you know, what we've been talking about up until now are all the things that people can do. So I just want to encourage people to, you know, go to the website, sign up, get involved at the state level, help us build the 2020 campaign, watch the candidates' statements about independence and reform, and send that information in to us. You know, we're tracking all of that, and we want to be interacting with all of the candidates as they start to travel around New Hampshire. Tiani Coleman's been doing some of that. We really want to build that out in Iowa, New Hampshire, and other parts of the country. But please join up and get connected to engaging with the state party leaders in your state so we can get everybody on record and really push this issue of independence. But let me just wrap with this. I do have something that I want to ask everyone to do that's very, very concrete, and you can do it tonight. I would like to ask everyone on the call to become a monthly donor to the Eyes on 2020 campaign. I want to ask everyone to sign up and pledge to give $10 or $20 or $50 a month, more if you can afford it, but whatever you can give. We're now building our online fundraising, and Sarah Lyons is leading that effort, and she told me that she is setting an ambitious goal for us, which is to have 1,000 people giving at least $10 a month to Eyes on 2020. So having that 1,000 donors would be huge. It's part of making them feel us and making us visible. It would mean that we have thousands of dollars every month to invest directly into mobilizing independent voters all over the country. So I want to ask every single person on this call, every single person, to get the ball rolling towards our 1,000 monthly sustainers by your making a monthly donation to the campaign. I know we can do this. The cabinet leading the campaign has done a great job, and literally there are millions and millions of independent voters out there who are waiting to hear from us, and it starts with us, and we need to have the capacity to reach them. So donating is easy to do. All you have to do is go to the independentvoting.org website, click on the Eyes on 2020 in the menu bar at the top, and it will take you right to the blog and the donate page. So please, please, please do that tonight. And with that, I think I'm going to wrap up, and I just want to thank all of you for being part of this call tonight, and a special thank you to Randy and Gwen and to the 120 people who sent in questions. Hope I gave you a little bit of some answers to what you're interested in knowing about. So good night, everyone, and be well, be safe, take care, and let's build our movement and grow.
Thank you so much, Jackie. So let me just reemphasize, everybody, please go to the Eyes on 2020 site tonight and become a sustainer. And I am going to send you a follow-up email tomorrow, so there will be a link for you to click on there. And I will include other ways to get involved. Please remember our next call is Monday, May 13th, so please put that on your calendar. And thank you very much. Have a good night, everybody.